So many of you have been coming here for many years, and those of you who haven't been coming for such a long time, you may have got some of the talks which I've given on from the library. You can download them from the internet. And even when I go overseas, they're put on the internet. So I've given so many talks, I mean, literally thousands of talks. So it's very hard to give a new talk, which I haven't mentioned before, but thinking about what the heck am I going to talk about this evening on the way up here, just one of the people in the car gave me a wonderful idea. And so this evening's talk is going to be on a title I've never broached before. It's going to be about Buddhism and bananas. I don't think any monk has given a talk on Buddhism and bananas before. And what encourages me is that at our Kalyanamitta youth group, they reminded me that some weeks earlier I'd given a talk on Buddhism and coffins, which turned out to be quite a popular talk. Even though the subject matter sounded a bit grim, it became a bit of fun. But Buddhism and bananas is the title of this evening's talk. And you find out the spiritual meaning of that banana is much deeper than you ever imagined. Whereas the banana has been a simile which has been used in many teachings which make you understand how your mind works and can relieve many problems. And I've got a special request because this talk and other talks from now on, our friends from our local prison, Carnot Prison Farm, is doing community work up at our monastery, told me that these talks are, and I got permission to be shown to the guests of Carnot Prison Farm. So, hi guys, welcome from Dhammaloka Buddhist Centre to Carnot Prison Farm guests. And the talk on Buddhism and bananas, the first little simile where they understand the meaning of bananas. I was only told this today, and it's amazing just how many new things you can learn. That they were saying when you peel a banana, you know, I've had this problem before when it's just so hard to peel, to open up that banana, and sometimes you squash it as you're trying to open it up to eat it. But it's because as human beings, we're not the experts on bananas. Now, who are the experts on bananas? You should know that the experts are monkeys. And apparently, if you ever watch a monkey eat a banana, so I'm told, it peels it at the bottom, not the top. And so I'm going to ask you, the next time you get a banana, try peeling it from the bottom instead of the top. And you will find you'll have much less suffering. And that is the whole reason why people come here, to realize that many of the things and attitudes they have to life, it causes so much suffering. And metaphorically, you are peeling the banana from the wrong end. And instead of doing what you've been taught for centuries to do, do what the experts do. Look at the monkey and see how it peels a banana. And then when you learn from the experts, then you'll have much less suffering in life, which is why you come to this place to learn from the experts how to live your life. And don't just do what you're doing. Look at the monks and the nuns. We're the experts. How do we peel our bananas? How do we live our life? How do we deal with the busyness and suffering of life? So instead of when you've got lots and lots of things to do, trying to work even harder to get things done, that's just peeling the banana from the wrong end. Have a look at what the monks do and the nuns do when they have lots of work to do. And I've been very busy this afternoon, running around trying to get things because I've been working again at our teacher's cottage in Jhana Grove, putting on the roof. I love doing this, especially last week because it was really wet. I got really muddy You know, it's lovely getting muddy again as a senior monk, because, you know, sometimes if you're a monk, you look like upon some sort of vicar or some reverend. You're put on such a high position. It is as if, no, Ajahn Brahm, don't do that. Let me do it. So it's like being a kid again, mucking around in the puddles and getting all mud all over myself and getting told off by my mother, you know, you should look after yourself. And I'm enjoying myself, boys being boys. That's, you know, underneath us, we're still big kids at Bodhinyana Monastery. And so we have a lot of fun. And isn't that important in life? Doesn't matter how old you are or how senior you are, remember play is important. So sometimes you look upon how the monks live together. So we have our playtime. Wouldn't it be wonderful if in your company, where you work, you have a little playground? So everyone in your office could go on the swings or whatever else it is, play together. I think you'll have much more harmony over in your office. And I actually, the other day, we actually did go to meet the members of Parliament, because a few weeks ago it was Waysak Day. Dennis was there. I really should have encouraged the government, you know, of our state parliament to have some swings in the little awesome roundabout so they could play every now and again. And I'm sure if they let off steam in the playground, they would not get so upset with each other and argue with each other. A little bit of play, in other words, a bit of fun, not taking life so seriously every moment of the day, creates a lot of harmony, a lot of sort of esprit de corps, which means, like, you know, learning how to work together to respect one another. But one of the most important things with play, when play, when you're not allowing your mind to go in one direction, you're allowing it to sort of go off into weird directions. And when you experiment that way, you come up with some very interesting new ideas. So play is really important. And that's why sometimes, that, you know, as a monk, you just look at different things and different ways of doing things. And that little playfulness, you know, which is part of my character, and I haven't given up and I will never be that serious that I now forget to laugh, that gives you the innovation, looking at life in different ways and not getting so upset and bogged down in things like depression and negativity. Because how can you get bogged down in negativity and depression when you've got this playful attitude, you know, towards your life? So because I'm very, very playful, yeah, I get in trouble sometimes, but you also have a lot of innovation happens as well. It's how we experiment. So in your life, don't be so serious. Look, what's one of the most serious things you can do in life? Go to a funeral service. I mean, how many of you have gone to a funeral service and you've left so miserable at the end of it? I mean, is that really what... Now, one person's already dead. You don't want any more people to die as a result, and with depression and grief and something like that. So it's best, actually to even have a little bit of playfulness in a funeral ceremony. I remember just years ago, I told a story to someone recently. Years and years ago, when I just came to Perth, there was this young man. He died. He was only about 23, 24, 25. And he died of cancer, and of course his parents were devastated. They came, he was just a migrant from UK, and his parents flew all the way over from UK, you know, for the funeral service. And because this young man was a Buddhist, and I went to see him when he was dying, and he sort of put in his word, he wanted me to do his funeral service. So I rocked up to do his funeral service. Now imagine these very, very conservative English family from this little village somewhere in Dorset somewhere. You know, the typical English gentleman and his wife. And they came to the funeral service and they saw, this was about 25 years ago, they saw their son who died tragically. The funeral service was being given by someone who was dressed so weird, they'd never seen anybody like this before. And I could see that their mouths drop and say, can't we get a proper person to give our son's funeral for us? And they could see from the very beginning that, I know, they didn't have any respect. They were very unsure whether they should go ahead with a funeral service for their son by a person whose religion they didn't understand. But that was in his will. But after the funeral service was completed, they were so impressed that not only did they ask for their son's ashes to be sprinkled at Bodhinyana Monastery where they were, but they also put in their will that when they die, they want me to do their funeral service for them. And also, now Leevak actually quite a big donation for Bodhinyana Monastery. And now mother died not so long ago, so her ashes at Bodhinyana Monastery. The husband, I've seen him every now and again, and he's, I'm up there, remember, just a few more years to go. And it was wonderful, just the very fact that you could actually take someone who was just grief-stricken at the loss of their son at such a young age and turn them around and give them a sense of peace and happiness and even like playfulness with the idea of death. It's amazing just what you can do. And because Buddhists, we, as I said a few weeks ago, we're the experts on death. You know why we're the experts on death more than any other religion? Buddhists know more about death because we've been reincarnated so many times. We've got experience. And if you're a Christian or Muslim or a Jew, you only get born once, so you only die once, but we've been dead many times. So, we are the experts. So just like if you want to know how to peel a banana, go to the experts, the monkeys. If you want to know about death, go to the experts, the monks, the Buddhists, because we've died many, many times. So, we've got experience. Come on. So it means it's less suffering for you. So this is actually why that when it comes to much of life, and one of the reasons we're experts in, say, psychology, is because we spend hours and hours over at Serpentine Monastery for years and years just meditating, looking at your mind and understanding how it works. And so if you actually spend hours and hours and hours every day, dealing with your mental world, you're going to learn something about, how your mind works. And that is why I'm sure that in this room there's many psychologists are here. And I never forget the one compliment which I got from one psychologist who was in a very tough area dealing with survivors of trauma and torture. And she was actually said that, all the piece of paper which she got so she could actually work, came from university. But all the practical stuff she learned from here. On a Friday night at Dhammaloka Buddhist Center. So all this sort of stuff, the psychology which she was putting into use, helping people get out of this terrible pain and memory of trauma, came from here. So these are the experts. And what sort of thing do I mean? The second banana simile. Some time ago, I think it was last year sometime, I was coming back from teaching in Melbourne or Sydney somewhere. You know that very often I'm not here because I don't just help out teaching in this group. I teach all over the place, teaching in Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, many, many countries, and Sri Lanka as well, and also over east. And because I travel around a lot, one of the biggest problems being a monk is our rule means we can only eat in the morning time from dawn until noon. And when you're traveling, sometimes that causes a lot of problems. And so this particular time, I had a couple of bananas in my bag just to augment just a very light meal you get on an aircraft. Now, you know what aircraft food is like, it may sort of sound nice on the menu, but when you've got it, it's such small portions. And it's even like a kid's portion. So I had a couple of bananas, and so, of course, I had those bananas with the meal. It's nice, healthy food. But then when I came back to Perth Airport, they had the sniffer dog. And, of course, the sniffer dog went right into my bag, and I got pulled over again. The second time I got pulled over, the first time I got pulled over, I actually mentioned that in the sort of my book, Open the Door of Your Heart. It was many years ago when I came back from Sri Lanka. And that was a very fascinating experience because many years ago, maybe 15 or 20 years ago now, when you had to go in these long lines waiting to get to the immigration to see your passport. Now you get a quick check through. But waiting there, they took the sniffer dog looking for people with drugs. And that was a special dog. And of course, it went up and down the lines. And if ever you've had that experience of the sniffer dog sniffing your baggage, isn't it a relief when it actually goes past? But even though you have got nothing in their bags, it's still, you know, you think, oh, goodness, thank goodness it's gone past. But it never went past me. As soon as it got to me, it literally buried its nozzle, its nose, you know, not nozzle, nose, in its in my robe and started wagging its tail furiously. And these guys, they had to actually to drag it with all its force away from me. And, of course, as soon as that happened, you know, the person who was actually talking to me beforehand, they just, you know, moved away from me. And, you know, you felt all these eyes staring at you. And so, you know, they're a bit worried about me. But, of course, the dog came up a second time. You know how long it takes to get through that airport. And so there was enough time there to actually to come out a second. That second time it happened again. The dog put its nose right inside of me and they pulled it away. And people were really looking at me now. You know, the drug runner. And so, of course, when you went through the customs, you know, whenever I go anywhere, I don't carry very much. And so, you know, I got a bowl and my little bag here. And so as soon as I went through customs, green channel, of course, that never worked. Come over here, sir. Can you please explain, after going through my bag, can you please explain why that dog stopped two times? And of course, I said, because Buddhist monks have got loving kindness, we're compassionate. I really thought I'd get in trouble saying things like that, but the guy actually took it, well, okay, get out of here. Sometimes being cheeky actually pays. But this other time, it got in my bag and the customs officer, and this was in Perth Airport, domestic flight, he said, were you having any bananas or anything in the bag? I said, yeah, I had two bananas for lunch, you know. Actually, I have imported them into Australia because they're in my tummy right now. But he said, that doesn't count, you can go. And what was really amazing was the very fact that they'd been in your bag, they left a scent, they left a residue, and the dog could pick it up. And that reminded me, whatever you do in your life, that leaves a residue. It's a law of karma. So if you put beautiful things in your life, you know, the dogs actually smell them and they can wag their tail. If you put ugly things in your life, it causes a lot of pain for you. Things have residues, like bananas leave their smell in the bag and these little dogs can actually sniff it out. So that's why that when I know that whatever I do, whatever I say, however I act leaves a residue in my life and other people actually affects them, and understands that, you know, it's in my interest and it's in other people's interest to put a lot of good things into my life. Because bananas leave smells. Your actions, your deeds, and even your thoughts, they leave a smell in life. And isn't it wonderful that, you know, when you've lived a good day and you've done lots of good things, people actually get a lot of happiness and peace out of that. You know, sometimes, again, I do really work very, very hard, but I always sleep well at night. You know, I don't need to take sleeping tablets or alcohol and other stuff which people actually take to try and get to sleep at night. And why is that? Because a lot of times I look back on my day, you know, when you know, before you go to bed at night, you know, you look back, what have I done today? And I think all these wonderful things you've achieved, you know, all the help you've given people, whether it's building a monastery, looking after monks or nuns, looking after you guys, and really, you know, sometimes I do work very hard, you know, trying to serve the community, whether it's just somebody calls up and they want some counselling over the phone because they have trouble with, like, a person even rang from Sri Lanka the other day. I don't know her at all, but she rang because, you know, she's having trouble getting a job in Sri Lanka. So I had to give her interview counselling on how to sort of get a job and apply for a job. Then sometimes I think to myself, why are you ringing me up? You know, I'm a monk. I'm not sort of, you know, a counsellor for, you know, getting you jobs. But you do this. And why do you do this? Because, you know, it's kindness. Yeah, okay, it takes a 5 minutes of your time or even longer, 10 minutes. But afterwards, you feel a beautiful, warm feeling inside of yourself. You know, it does leave a residue, and it leaves a residue for many days. And if ever you do something mean and nasty, well, look, I mean, I was really in a rush trying to get to a metal place today because I needed, and I've been building again because I enjoy building. I was saying I got all dirty and muddy, And I needed some brackets, you know, to put on the fascia. And they didn't have it in one store, and they didn't have it in the second store, but they said they'd have it in the third store. But it was getting close to 4:30, and I thought the store was going to close at 4:30. So I asked the driver, can you just, you know, rush a little bit? And, you know, it was a yellow light, so you can go through. And he stopped. And I feel very guilty for that. I mean, I'm a monk. I shouldn't be in a rush. So that left a residue inside of me. So I'm sorry, Trent. I won't do that again. So even me, if I do something which, no, it's not really a bad thing. But anyway, the shop closed at 4 o'clock anyway, so it was a total waste of time. But anyhow, just actually doing any things like that, you know, you feel a little bit bad about it. It leaves a bit of a residue. So when I remember that, look, if I'm going to live a happy life, and if I'm not going to have any of this feeling of regret and remorse, I shouldn't have done that, why did I do that? Please do a lot of good things in your life. And whenever you sort of, you know, you even got any doubt, should I do this, should I not do this, have just a little pause before you act. This is one of the problems with people, and I made a mistake, because you're in a rush, you forget really what you're doing. You don't have a pause to be mindful enough to say, you know, is this going to leave a residue in my life? And what type of residue is it going to leave? I'm going to have to live with myself, and other people are also going to have to live with me. So I'm going to make sure that, you know, I'm not going to do things which I regret afterwards. It's just not worth it. So, but also remember to pause as well. Those pauses in life are very important. That's what we mean by mindfulness. Just stop for a little while and think, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? And if you have that pause time, it really, really is very, very helpful. There is one little psychology trick. I don't know, I think I taught this in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago when I was over there. And I mentioned this here before, but I'm going to repeat this because this is a great way of dealing with people who get angry at you and start shouting at you. And sometimes that happens very often. If it's at work, if it's at home, if it's, you know, just, you know, in a shop somewhere, and somebody starts berating you and shouting, you're getting very angry at you, what most people do, as soon as they finish, you go and argue back again. Now, that's missing this golden opportunity of the five-second pause. And that five-second pause, when someone's arguing at you, they're ranting at you, when they stop, you wait at least 5 seconds before you start speaking. Because in those 5 seconds, when you're not saying anything, the only thing left in that person's mind, the one who's just been shouting at you, is the residue of what they've just said. The smell of the banana. And that's all they've got. And in those 5 seconds, you realize, or they realize, what they've just done and what they've said and how badly they've acted. If you don't give them that 5 second pause, they never have the space to consider the bad speech they've just delivered. And you'll find that that means the person who just shouted at you will actually learn that they've done something which is not nice, which is, you know, quite unskillful. And it means you're helping them train, learn, understand, so they don't get so upset in the future. You're giving them the 5 seconds of mindfulness where they can reflect on what they've just said. But of course, if as soon as they finish, you give it back as good as you've got, of course, they get no time to reflect. In fact, all they're really sort of thinking about is you and just how bad you are and how stupid you are and how you really deserve that and I've really given you what you deserved. They get no time to reflect on their own actions. That's one of the problems why people actually don't become better people, why they don't become spiritual people, because they don't have that time to reflect. So if anyone gets angry and upset at you, remember, give them that 5 second pause at least for them to be able to reflect on what they've just said, for them to smell the residue of the banana. And then actually, you're helping them, you're learning. And whenever anybody does something beautiful and good, praise them. Encourage them to remember the beautiful stuff they've done. And if they remember the beautiful stuff they've done with praise, acknowledgement, prizes, whatever, then you're learning, they're learning how to enjoy the delicious, fragrant residue of their actions. And when they keep remembering the fragrant residue of their actions, of course, it encourages more good actions. Being a good person is not something you just decide to do. It's something how you learn to do it, how you train yourself to be good. I was reading the psychology magazine recently that, you know, because of experimenting with Buddhist monks, at last they discovered that you can actually train to be compassionate. It's not something you just are, it's something which you learn. It's a sort of a, they call it the plasticity of the brain. You're not born with compassion, you're not born with anger, you can learn those things. And, you know, the Buddhism gives you these great techniques how to learn them. And that's just one way of learning how to be a kinder, more compassionate, less angry, less depressed person. And see the residue of your actions. And once you taste that, it's very easy to make sure you get good actions and not bad actions. You train, you grow, you develop. And that's the beautiful simile of the residue of the banana. But one of the problems is that sometimes that, you know, we get so attached, you know, to some things in life, so attached to getting my things on time, so attached to getting your own way, so attached to the people you live with, that sometimes, especially when there is something like a death in a family, we just can't let people go. We can't let things go. And that's the third, and this is perhaps the most famous of the banana similes of the Dhamma, of Buddhism, because this was very similar to one which was said by the Buddha himself. It has been used for long periods of time, many centuries in Buddhism. And this was actually how that people actually catch monkeys. And if you want to catch a monkey in the jungle, in the old ways of doing it, you would, very simple, just get a coconut, drink the milk, hollow it out, but just leave a hole in the coconut just big enough for a monkey to put their paw in. And you tie the coconut to a tree with a strong rope. And all you need to do is put a banana in the coconut and leave it overnight. And of course, a monkey will find that banana inside the coconut. We'll be able to smell it. It will put its little paw inside the coconut to get the banana out. But remember, the hole is just big enough to get the paw in, but not big enough to get a paw with a banana in the middle out. And so the monkey tries all night to try and get that banana out, but can't do it. It's impossible. And when the person comes, whether it's a hunter or someone wanting that monkey to take to a zoo, comes, that monkey sees the hunter coming and tries even harder to get the banana out, but he can't get it out. And frantically, the hunter just ambles at a natural pace, taking his time. The monkey gets desperate. And of course, that's how the hunter catches the monkey. And what does the monkey need to do to escape? Just let the banana go and take its paw out and he can get away very quickly. But can the monkey do that? No, because that's my banana and I found it. And that's a beautiful simile of actually your life. Why is it we can't let these things go? Why is it that they kill us or imprison us or make us suffer so much? Why? Because it's my purse, it's my car, it's my son, it's my wife. Why can't you let her go? When the hunter comes up. It's always because our sense of ownership of these things. Look, there's many other bananas in the forest. There's many other cars you can get. So why kill yourself? I know sort of every time I fly on the aircraft, they always say, look, if there's an emergency, and they tell you where the chutes are, where the exits are, don't take any baggage with you. And of course, people will take that baggage with them, just like that monkey, because it's my baggage, it's important for me, and they will kill themselves that way. So Why is it that so many times it's because of attachments to things? What actually is that attachment anyway? Just like I said, the monkey thinks, I own that banana, it is mine. And that is why in Buddhism, a basic teaching, whenever you think it's mine, we call it in Buddhism the mind field. And if you step on that, it blows you up. Do you know why they have mines? You know, the land mines and mine, why? They come from the same source. Whenever there's a mine, it's a mine field, and it's going to blow something up, and you're going to get injured or killed. So in Buddhism, we always say, what do we actually own? Now, I've told you many times, if you think you own your wife or you own your husband, your relationship is in a big problem. You don't own people. What's it like to feel like you're owned by somebody? Is it terrible? It's like you're a prisoner again. You're not owned by anybody. You share your lives together. No one owns, but you share. Your children. I've mentioned a lot here too. The biggest problem with parents is think that's my son, my daughter. Another minefield again. Which means you have to worry about them when they're 30, 40, 50 years of age. Come on, guys. Come on, girls. Remember the simile of the bird. When a bird hatches its chicks, they look after those chicks so well. They feed it, even they sit on those hard eggs. You think you've got a sore bottom sitting on the ground here. Imagine big, round eggs your bum is sitting on. Think of those poor chickens. That must really be a sore. They haven't got like soft cushions to sit on like you guys have. Just hard eggs, day after day after day to hatch those eggs. And then feeding them all sorts of worms or whatever. They don't get anything for themselves. Mum and dad just put stuff down their mouth just like it's, you know, just some endless pit, like a vacuum cleaner, just sucking everything which they can give into it. And then they teach the birds how to fly. But of course, as soon as a bird can fly, bye-bye, son. Bye-bye, daughter. Mum and dad are off now. Can't you do that with your kids? Once your kids grown up, once they are, you know, got their first job, university, whatever, then bye-bye, son. Bye-bye, daughter. We've looked after you. You know, you find your own house. Can you do that? No, why? Because it's my son and my daughter. That's a big problem with people. And it also means it also means that the kids don't learn responsibility. They don't learn how to look after themselves. Mum and dad look after them a bit too much. So please, remember that simile of a bird. And when it is time to let go, there's sometimes that, you know, you can't do much about it. They have to go. So let them go with your blessing. They're going to go anyway. Let them go with love rather than with regret. The same way when a person leaves for another country or they eventually die, please let them go with love, not with tears. Because we have to let these things go because they're not ours. These kids, they come into our lives for so many years. Where they come from, we don't know. After you die, where do they go to? We don't know. They just come and they go. This is our friends in life. So the relationships we have, long-term relationships, short-term relationships, nothing will last because it's not ours. We share the time together. We enjoy those moments. We cherish them. But when they're gone, we let them go without lingering. That's a great thing about which I was taught with Buddhism. You enjoy the time you have together. But when it's over, just like the great concert, you feel so happy, so privileged to have been there and having this wonderful time together. And when you leave the great concerts of life, you know, your friends, your relationships, your time at school, whatever it is, when it's ended, you never cry. Because it's a wonderful concert. You feel inspired. Blessed. What a wonderful time that was. That's what we mean by not ownership. That's what we mean by enjoying the moment, enjoying the concert. When it's over, never a tear, but a sense of happiness and privilege. But it's hard sometimes to find kids, you know, who are just beautiful kids. It's hard to find a beautiful wife who's absolutely perfect, a husband who's just such a beautiful, sensitive guy. Because all bananas, the next simile, all bananas are bent. I've never yet seen a straight banana. So have you ever seen a perfect guy? Have you ever seen a perfect girl? Have you ever seen a perfect son or perfect daughter? No! And this is one of the other problems. They come up to me and they complain about their kids. And of course, the standard answer when they say, you know, their kid is doing this and kid is doing that, and you know, they're not coming home, and saying, what did you do when you were that age? That's not got nothing to do with it, Ajahn Brahm. Of course it has something to do with it. I went to this conference in Melbourne a few years ago, and this child psychologist, he was a neuroscientist, they brought all the way over from the United States somewhere, an expert in the field. It was just, first thing he did was put these quotes on the sort of the screen. The first one was from Socrates. Now, that's that 2,400 years ago, from ancient Greece, complaining about his kids. Children haven't changed. They're still just, they drive you crazy, just as they drove Socrates crazy. It's nothing to do with our modern culture and all the sort of computer games and just the freedom and lack of respect. That lack of respect has been there for 2,600 years. You went through that, I went through that. Be honest with it. So look, kids are kids. They get into trouble and they experiment. I got into heaps and heaps of trouble. That's why now I'm a bit afraid if any of my old school friends or especially university friends came over here because they got some pictures, some photographs. I know they've got them and they were very embarrassed. Because sometimes people got the idea, you know, you're a monk. They think, you know, you're some like you were holy from the time you were born. It was true, according to my mother, that I was bald when I came out of her womb. So I was destined to be a monk. But I didn't behave like a monk when I was young. So, you know, we're normal people, like, you know, people are bent as well. So you can't get a banana which is straight. What Ajahn Chah used to say, getting someone who's perfect is like looking for a tortoise with a moustache. So I like to say it's looking for the straight banana. There's no such thing as a straight banana. Bananas are bent. That's their nature. Isn't it beautiful that they're bent? They wouldn't taste so nice if they weren't. So your wife, she's a bit bent, okay? Your husband is too. And your kids, they're not perfect, and that makes them lovable. If they were perfect, there would be no reason to love them. Come on, you understand that. You know, what's the difficulty in love if it's perfect? Love is something which accepts a person for who they are, no matter what they are. In other words, embraces somebody's faults and defects. And isn't it wonderful when you receive a love like that? You know, they love me for being Ajahn Brahm, saying all the stupid jokes, all the sort of, sometimes going a bit over the top with some of the language, whatever it is. Isn't it nice that, you know, I've got my idiosyncrasies. I'm not perfect. I never will be a perfect because you're a human being, and that makes you lovable. This Buddhist society, this place will never be perfect. There'll always be something wrong, some dirt on the carpet, some doors which don't open, some toilet which gets blocked. Welcome to the world. This Buddhist center and the Buddhist Society of WA are as bent as a banana. They never will be perfect because we're just a group of human beings and that makes us lovable. And you know, that's one of the most wonderful things to understand about Buddhism when I was a monk. I don't need to be perfect. I can be bent like a banana. And try to straighten yourself. Have you ever tried to straighten a banana out? You just squash it and it all goes all squelchy. You can't straighten a banana. The banana's nature is to be like that. So all you can do is to love your banana, even though it's bent. So to love your wife, even though, you know, she's not exactly perfect. To love your husband, even though sometimes he's really bent, and double sometimes, really all over the place. He's not perfect, but that's why we love. And for me to know that you didn't need to be perfect was this great relief. Because I got somewhere inside of me, maybe because of my upbringing, that if you had some imperfection, you had to fix it up. You were wrong, you were a failure, you were deficient. In other words, I couldn't even respect myself. I had to make myself perfect first, and then I could get respect from my parents, from my teachers, from my friends. That's just such a pain. And many of you have been dealing with that all your life, just trying to be perfect for somebody else. And you try and do your best, but you'll never make that perfection. You never find any peace or happiness, fulfillment, never any contentment in your life trying to be perfect. So after a while, I gave up. Gave up trying to be perfect. Just be by your, be who you are. And you had this great insight afterwards. When I was who I was a perfect banana. Just spent just the right amount. Just like everybody else. The great thing is, when you realize you don't have to be perfect, then you become perfect. When you try to be perfect, then you'll always be failing. Always be have this great sense of lack of self-worth, never being good enough, never being able to make it in life, never have any possibility of contentment. There's too many things to fix up. So remember, all bananas are like that. You are good enough. You are perfect. And then you can have this beautiful sense of contentment at last, freedom at last. Now, the other banana simile which I wanted to bring up is one I usually keep just for meditation retreats. Because, you know, Buddhism and bananas, they really go together somehow or other. And this particular simile was given to me by a Sri Lankan man many, many years ago. It's a very beautiful simile, because when we do our meditation, have you ever noticed this, when your mind wanders all over the place? And that in Buddhism, we call that the monkey mind, because in the forest, the monkeys, they go all over here, there, and all over the place. And have you ever also noticed that sometimes that, yeah, you know, you meditate when you come here, maybe if you make it on time of a Friday evening, but how much time do you spend meditating at home? Why is that? You know, because you got so many things to do. Life is so busy. So this particular monkey story was a very beautiful one. This was one day at Waisak Day, over in some monastery over in Sri Lanka. You know, a Waisak Day, that's when we just had the Waisak ceremony a week or two ago, and that's when we celebrate the birth, enlightenment, and final passing away of the Buddha. So it's the biggest day in the whole year for Buddhists. So all these people were going to this temple in Sri Lanka on this Waisak Day, and because there were so many people at the temple, a monkey, he came from the jungle into the temple just to see if he could get something to eat, because someone was bound to drop something. And of course, the monkeys are very, very quick. They'd take that, you know, that mango or that sort of banana, and they'd just steal it and eat it and get something for free. So whenever there was a big ceremony, the monkeys would love to come to the temple. So the monkey came to the temple looking for something to eat, but what happened? There was a monk who was giving a sermon, giving a talk. And the monkey heard the word, monkey mind. And you think, oh, that's interesting. This priest, this Buddhist monk, is talking about me. So he went to the window to listen. But when he heard what this monk was saying about a monkey mind is bad, it's terrible, it's the sort of thing you're supposed to get rid of. You know, and if you've got a monkey mind, you're not much of a Buddhist meditator and you should do much better than that. This monkey heard that monkey mind was a bad thing. And the monkey got very upset. Even monkeys have feelings, you know. And he said, this monk, he's defaming me. He's saying a monkey mind is bad. What's wrong with a monkey mind? He can't get away with that. And there, all these human beings are trying to get rid of a monkey mind. I quite like my monkey mind. This is not good enough. I'm going to complain about this. This is defamation. This is slander. What's wrong with a monkey mind? I'm a monkey. We should... No, monkey mind's rights. And he was so upset with the way this monk talked about a monkey mind and put a monkey mind down. He went back into the jungle and he went to the leader of his pack of monkeys, his group of monkeys, and started complaining. You should hear what these monks in that temple are saying about us. They're saying monkey mind is a bad mind, it's an evil mind, it's a terrible mind. You should try and get rid of your monkey mind. He's putting us down. He's scolding us. And all the other monkeys were really upset. They can't get away with this. Now, we shouldn't allow this. You know, there's no Human Rights Commission, Amnesty International, or, you know, World Wildlife Fund. We should complain, somebody. And at that, they were jumping up and down so much that the head monk stopped them all. Head monkey stopped them all. I've got to be very careful here. There is a difference. There is a big difference. The leader of the monkeys told everyone, stop. See how you're all jumping up and down, complaining? He said, that monk was right. That is the monkey mind. Jumping up and down, complaining all the time, never being able to be still. And all the monkeys were wise enough to say, oh my goodness, you're right. A monkey mind is a bad mind. And they all got depressed. They said, what are we going to do? We've been born with a monkey mind. How can we get rid of a monkey mind? And one of the monkeys said, I've done it again. One of the monkeys said, well, look, I've also been to that Buddhist temple. And how people get rid of the monkey mind is by meditating. And they say, we monkeys, we should also meditate. And then our monkey minds will be peaceful minds. And when people see us, they would actually want to have peaceful monkey minds rather than monkey minds which keep jumping up and down. So let's meditate. So all the monkeys jumped up and down. Yeah, let's meditate. We want to meditate. Yes, shut up. That's more monkey mind. So I said, how do we meditate? So this one monkey said, look, it's very easy. I've seen the monks in the temple. You put your right leg over your left leg. And you put your right paw over your left paw, back straight, head down. I don't know what you do next, but they stay like that for a long time. So all the monkeys, they saw also they got little cushions. So they went into the jungle. They got some grass and some leaves. They made little cushions for themselves, little zafus. And they put there, sat down. Now, all this whole herd of monkeys, the first time any monkeys had meditated. And they put their right leg over their left leg. The right paw over the left paw, straight backs, heads down, and they started meditating. First time that ever happened. The jungle had never been so quiet for about 1 minute. And then a monkey put his paw up. Excuse me, he said. I've just been thinking. You know that we all planned, we decided this morning, we all planned that for lunch, we go to the banana plantation just down the road, steal the bananas for lunch. And I haven't been able to get rid of that thought. So it's been disturbing my meditation. So my plan is this. We can all swing over to the banana plantation, steal the bananas. You know, get it out of the way, first of all, so I don't have to think about it. And all the other monkeys, yay, let's get it out of the way. I've been thinking about that too. So they all got up from their seats. And they swang over to the banana plantation. They stole lots and lots of bananas. And they brought it back. It wasn't lunchtime yet. They just decided to steal the bananas, but not to eat them because it wasn't the right time. And they put them in this big pile in the middle. Then they went back onto their cushions. Right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw. Now head tucked in, started meditating again. And the jungle was quiet again. This time for about 30 seconds. Excuse me, said one of the monkeys. Said, I've just been thinking, all those bananas in the center, you know, before we eat them, we have to peel them first. So can we get that out of the way, first of all? But we won't eat them yet, we'll just peel them. And all the other monkeys said, yeah, I've been thinking the same thing. Let's peel the bananas. So they all decided, yeah, they'll peel the bananas. Just get it out of the way so then they can meditate. So they all went down there, peeled all the bananas. They didn't eat them yet because it wasn't lunchtime and put them all on a big pile in the center. And then they got back on their cushions, the right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, closed their eyes and peacefully meditating. Excuse me, said one of the monkeys, I've just had this idea. You know, before we eat those bananas, we have to put them in our mouth. So let's just put them in their mouth first of all. Just get that out of the way. And then we can meditate. Yeah, good idea. I've been thinking the same, said the other monkeys. So they all got a banana each. A couple of monkeys got two. One got three. You know what monkeys are like. Put them in their mouth. They didn't eat them yet. It wasn't lunchtime. They put one or two bananas in their mouth. Got back onto their meditation cushions. Right leg over the left leg. Right paw over the left paw. Their heads down and started. Could they meditate with bananas in their mouth? No way. When everybody closed their eyes, they ate all the bananas. And that's what we mean by a monkey mind. Let's get this out of the way first, and then I can meditate. Now that's the monkey mind. Let's get kindness out of the way first of all. Oh, not kindness. Let's get something else. Get all our business out of the way, and then we'll be kind. Let's get my $1 million in the bank first of all, and then we give a donation to the Nuns Monastery Building Fund. No, come on. If it always gets something out of the way first, it never gets done, does it? This is why that's called the monkey mind. What is really important? Not eating bananas, but meditating. What's really important? No, getting lots of money or being kind. What's really, really important? Doing all these jobs this weekend, which you're supposed to do, or just spending time with each other and resting and relaxing a bit. That's why I say, get the important things out of the way first of all. And what is really important in life? You know, you really know what's important in life. Spending time together if you're in a relationship. Just hanging out with your kids. Looking after your health so you're not so stressed out. Coming to the Buddhist Society, listening to some decent talks, which will be good for your life. Being kind, being generous, your spiritual life, that's really important. Everything else comes second. So remember, get the important things out of the way first of all. And if you know how to get the important things out of the way, in other words, peace, kindness, love, generosity, the other things come second, then you won't be a monkey. You won't be someone always swinging through trees onto the next thing, never finding any peace or happiness in life. So that was the last of the monkey similes. So you see from this talk which I've given today, bananas and monkeys and monks, we have some sort of connection there with Buddhism. So Buddhism and bananas is very, very important. And to go back to the very, very first simile, next time you can get a banana if you can afford one, because they're very expensive now. That's why all the monkeys are rich. If you can find a banana, try peeling it from the bottom next time and see if it works. It's amazing. Something which was so obvious to you for so many years was wrong. And where did you learn it? Here, at the Buddhist Society. It's amazing what you learn when you come here on a Friday night. Things which you never heard before, which solve a lot of suffering in your life. Doing things in a different way. That is the meaning of spirituality. Not going in the ways, the old ways, which have caused too much pain and harm and suffering. Doing things differently. Easy to do. Delicious. And you'll have lots of satisfaction. That is the talk this evening on Buddhism and bananas. There you go, I got away with that this evening. And no other person has given a talk on bananas and Buddhism before. Okay, any questions on that talk? There you go, it's fun. Instead of saying the old stories all the time, something new. Any questions? Okay, going. Yeah, where? Okay, you're going bananas, yeah. is compassion just learned in the home, or do schools have a role in that? Schools have a huge role in teaching kindness and compassion. And simply because the earlier you learn the skills of life, the less problems and difficulties you have. You know, I really wish I had had more teachings on kindness and compassion and forgiveness when I was young. You'd made much more progress. So, yes. Okay, you say there is some mental health courses, but compassion is not teached as an actual topic in the school. Look, sometimes I think you know as a school teacher that most of the things you learn in school are not just the lessons of history and geography. It's actually you learn from almost osmosis, from the people around you. You know, if the teachers, the psychologists, the janitor or whoever else is working in that school actually practices compassion, that's what you learn. Look, one of the school teachers I remember who was, you know, one of the most influential, his name was Mr. Howard. And the reason he was influential for me, he was always a very jolly fellow. You know, he was the head of mathematics. That's one of the reasons I was really interested in mathematics, because he was jolly, always happy, would never actually scold, but always be laughing at you and laughing with you. And if you made a mistake on the board, you know, and you picked it out, he praised you for it. He wouldn't criticize you at all. And I learned a lot of compassion and positive thinking just from just one little mentor when I was at school. And those jolly people, those happy people, those compassionate people, it's not a lesson you were taught, but it's something which you learned from the people who were in front of you. So it's not a lesson which is, you know, taught in the same way as, you know, computer science or whatever. This should be something in the character of the teachers. Is that the only way it should be taught in school? The prime way, obviously. And also, I mean, just by doing little acts of compassion, just getting a little kitten. We had a kitten in the room earlier. And, of course, no one came to talk with me when there was a kitten in the room, because the kitten was the centre of attention. It's so nice having a little kitten. It's such compassion. It just makes you sort of soft. You have to be a very, very hard person not to sort of feel this sense of softness and love and playfulness with a little kitten. So having more little pets at school, I don't know. Even in the... I'm not talking... They do have that in primary school, but have that in the sort of the year 12. So they learn a bit of kindness, compassion with each other. Yeah, I do. Yeah, you say there's a place for teaching it in a teaching form. Yeah, there is. But I think the most important thing, I could not teach compassion if I wasn't compassionate. Otherwise, it just would not sort of come. And it, you know, people would not sort of buy it. You know, if I was sort of gave a talk on compassion and afterwards say, "Why did you ask that question, you stupid man?" And you weren't compassionate. And then, of course, people think just big hypocrisy. So many people, you know, teach love and kill people for it afterwards, you know, if they don't agree. So, no, it has to come from practice, first of all. Otherwise, it doesn't come across. Okay, he's saying that compassion is taught in schools, it is part of the curriculum, it is taught explicitly. Very beautiful. So, the more compassion we have in our society, the better. And it even goes, compassion should be really taught, whatever course that is, please can we introduce that into Parliament House in Canberra and into the boardrooms of our big companies. And I'm trying to do my best to do that. Okay, thank you for those comments.
Very respectful Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.